Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. The first two items on the list, I really don't have a whole lot to say about. As I said in the previous episode, I kind of predicted this. There's a libqmi, which is a QMI library and utility set specifically for things that need to talk to WWAN modems and devices that can speak the Qualcomm MSM interface protocol. That's QMI, Qualcomm MSM interface. I don't know what that is, and I don't care. If I ever get a Qualcomm modem interface or whatever it was, then I'll learn about this then. And I don't know what I would have to say about this. So I'm going to basically skip it. So the next one is libtirpc. Now that's the transport independent RPC library. And if you've ever set up an NFS server, then you may have seen something about RPC. That is, that's a component of talking to an NFS server, and it was originally developed, I guess, by Sun, probably, NFS. And this libtirpc is a port of, Sun's Transport Independent RPC Library to Linux. I don't want to get this wrong, so I'm not going to go into too much detail, but as far as I can tell from reading literally through the source code of librpc or tirpc, I think that the RPC protocol is kind of the controller protocol for, in fact, what does it even stand for? Because that could, okay, remote procedure calls. That's kind of a sense of a controller. Meaning that it has functions like auth underscore destroy. So you're destroying, you're forgetting the authorization that exists. Client call, client control, client create, and so on. So as far as I can tell, without getting too far into, speculation and also sort of the inner workings of NFS, I think RPC is kind of the protocol you're using to communicate with the NFS server. Now, whether that's exactly correct or not, because there's also obviously the TCP and UDP protocol doing a lot of that lifting as well, but I believe that the RPC would be the component that an application would be using to initiate specific actions with the server. So that's as far as I can tell. I've set up an NFS server several times. I never had to think about the role that RPC played in that. So I it's pretty low, lying pretty low in the stack, I would imagine. NFS, I don't know. I can't get a good feel personally on how relevant it is. I mean, there's obviously, it'll be relevant for a long time just for legacy reasons. People set it up, it exists, people are going to need to support it until they really, really replace it with something else, for real. You do see that happen. You see organizations deprecate a solution and go to something else. But I think NFS is still a useful sort of local, like I need a file share solution. Like NFS is definitely one of the options that you have. NFS and Samba, right? Those are the two sort of obvious choices for that use case. And you can imagine all kinds of cloud storage schemes, and maybe, in some cases, that's where people are going. But in other cases, I think that just keeping it local and also just continuing to support all of the dozens of scripts and things that are already in place in the organization, it does make sense. So I guess NFS is still out there, and it's still probably relevant to some organizations, and not very to others. So next, so that's all the libs in the in section. Now it's links and links. These are great applications. I love them both. I can't live without them. I mean, really, they are just the best applications. They are web browsers, like proper web browsers for your terminal. Now, whether they are actually usable in 2024 depends largely on the site you're trying to use it on. If you are designing a site and you go to your site in links or links, one is spelt L-I-N-K-S, like the word links, and then the other is spelt L-Y-N-X, like the animal. But they both basically do the same thing. They're text-based browsers that you run in your terminal, and you use your keyboard to navigate a site. So if you are designing a site, and you go to your site in links or links, and you can't get your site to work, you have an accessibility problem. It's that's the easiest check to do. If you are worried about how are people going to see this website or access this website, and you can't do it through links, then you have an accessibility problem. And I don't mean the accessibility meaning like some kind of disability or a physical thing. I just mean all of accessibility, like the whole scope of that, of what we could mean by accessibility. Can people get there on any device, regardless of their particular situation? If they have no eyesight, can they parse your website? If they're on a very old phone, can they parse your website? If they're on the newest, latest, greatest technology, can they parse your website? All of the questions that you might have are essentially answered by links. If you can't do it in links, then you have an accessibility problem. I don't know how to tell people that enough. And I wish links and links was even more ubiquitous than they are. I mean, to you and me as Linux users, they're pretty ubiquitous, possibly. I mean, at least to me, they're ubiquitous. To a Slackware user, I guess, they're ubiquitous. I mean, they are on our machines, right? By default, they just appear on your machine. And to access either of these two browsers, you open up a terminal, and you type either L-I-N-K-S, and then maybe a site that you want to go to, for instance, GNUWorldOrder.info, or you can just launch the browser and then go to a site. And there's the GNU World Order website, looking actually quite good in text mode, if I do say so myself. Yep, this works. This works quite well. I would argue that this is a highly accessible site. I mean, I could see people on a flip phone getting to this website without a problem. Now, if I want to go to a different site, I press G and then enter a different website. So let's go to, let's go to twitter.com. I don't ever go to twitter.com, so I don't really know what to expect here, but let's twitter.com. Refresh, it says https://twitter.com/x/migrate?TOK=, and then a long string of letters. So I'm going to hit the right arrow to follow that link, and it tells me to refresh again. Hit the right arrow to follow that link, and now I'm on a new page that says, this browser is no longer supported. Please switch to a supported browser. Okay, so that's not useful. That is not a highly accessible website, which makes you wonder whether places that use Twitter for either promotion or, I mean, geez, even worse, emergency services, if that's such a great idea. So that's not a great result. Let's go to Facebook. Facebook.com. Actually, this looks kind of okay. It's got some refresh and some links junk up at the top. There's a bunch of menu. No, here's the login. So there's a login prompt. I mean, I don't know what would happen. I don't have a Facebook account, so I can't test. I don't know what would happen if you tried to log in there. But I mean, on the server, I mean, it's certainly more than I got from Twitter.com. Let's go to, I don't know, where else? What's another site that people go to? I really don't even know. I guess, that's the only sites I know of are Twitter and Facebook and GNU World Order. Well, let's go to Google, google.com. So google.com presents me with a brief menu along the top, and then there's a big, long sort of field. that I can go to. So really navigating, at least in links, L-I-N-K-S, you navigate maybe a little bit confusingly with your up and down arrow. Because if you hit the right or the left arrow, you're going through, you know, you're following a link or you're trying to go back. So that can get a little bit confusing if the presentation of the page, for instance, on Google, there's search, images, maps, play, YouTube, news, Gmail, Drive, more in a row. So it's written across the page. So I think the impulse would be to, at least to a sighted user, would be to follow the flow of the text. And you might think, okay, I'll hit right. Well, now you've just followed through on the slash images link. And so now you're in an image search. If I hit left, now I've gone back a page. So really, I would want to go down, even though the cursor on screen is moving to the right, but I'm hitting the down arrow. So I hit down arrow a bunch of times, and I get to the Google thing for some reason. That's weird. Now I'm in the field, the search field, so I should be able to just type in GNU World Order Podcast, and then hit return. That takes me out of the URL to the default field Google search. Now I can hit return to follow through, or I can just hit the right arrow again to follow through on that link. And yeah, it found GNU World Order .info, found it a couple of times, found it on Podbean, I don't know what that is, found it on podcasts.apple.com, found it on listennotes.com, yeah, a couple of places. So it looks good. I guess I'm doing really well on Google for people who exactly type in the name and qualification of the show. See, that's the kind of SEO that gets me all the traffic. Okay, so that's links. Up and down to navigate, right to follow through on a link, and back to go back. Q to quit. Now, LYNX links, GNU World Order .info, let's say. At first glance, you wouldn't be able to really even tell them apart. Links, LYNX, is a little bit more colorful. It makes the links, like on my rendering, it has green links and purple asterisks where for bullet lists or for, yeah, bullet lists. And so on, but the navigation is essentially the same. Again, go up and down to navigate, and then the right arrow to follow a link. Keyboard shortcuts are similar as well, so if you want to go to a site, you just press G for go, and then you type in the server, slackware.com, let's go to that. So it goes to slackware.com, that's looking good, as one might expect. Up and down to go to various places. It looks like, I couldn't remember which one it is, but it does look like in links LYNX, the space bar also follows a link. So that's kind of handy, I guess. Yeah. And in links LINKS, space bar just takes you down a page. So that's equally handy. Possibly you're getting the idea that you should arguably use one or the other, not both, and I would agree with that. If that's what you're thinking, I would encourage you to decide on that. It's hard to decide without knowing which is which, of course, or you know, like which interface you prefer, but it can be very confusing if you try to use links sometimes and links another at other times, just because, I mean, little things like that where the space bar on one follows a link and on the other scrolls down a page. Like, that's a pretty big difference. The up and down arrows and the right and left arrows, those basically behave the same. The way you get help is also different in the two programs. So links, LINKS, I don't know of a way to get to the help from within the application, which is a little bit strange, maybe, arguably. So you just type in, like, don't launch the application. In your terminal, you type in links space dash help, and then you get all the keystrokes that you'll need while using the application. Links, LYNX, you can always get to the help menu by pressing the question mark. Simple enough, even intuitive, one might argue. So no matter where you are, if you're within links, L-Y-N-X, you can just press question mark and you'll get the help menu. So it's really, really nice. It's very convenient. You don't worry about sort of not remembering how to do something and then having to open up another terminal window and looking up the help menu or something like that. It's all there. So I quite like that. I would say by impulse, I use L-Y-N-X. That's the one that I'm used to, insofar as I'm used to either of them. I mean, I don't use either of them on a daily basis by any means. But when I first found out that terminal web browsing was a possibility, that you could do that, it was back on a macOS laptop, believe it or not, that I was running entirely. I'd stripped out everything but the Unix parts of it, with varying levels of success. You can only strip it down so much. But I was launching an Enlightenment desktop at boot, and I was just using anything I could find in the Fink project, which is a Unix repository for macOS. Open source repository. And so this was before I switched to Linux, or even understood, you know, that Linux was a separate thing that I could do, I think. And so I was compiling stuff from Fink project by hand, and running everything just out of a terminal, and some things I just really couldn't find or figure out how to compile myself on Darwin, especially back then. Maybe even now, I don't know, although I suspect with Homebrew and things like that, that it's probably a lot better now. But back then, trying to compile stuff on a Darwin kernel, for a Darwin kernel, from within Unix, I mean, that is just, there just wasn't any support for it. And I got farther than maybe you would expect to get back in like 2004, 2005 time frame. But I ended up getting links from there, and that was the one that I could get to compile. I think that they also had links, L-I-N-K-S, and e-links, E-L-I-N-K-S, and probably, what's the other one? W3, I think it might just be W3, something like that, whatever that other one is, which I have used before in Emacs, I think. But anyway, so I ended up kind of familiar with L-Y-N-X, and that, and luckily Slackware also ships with that, so I just kind of keep going down that path. The sort of the problem with choosing one over the other, really, is that when you're on some other distribution that is not Slackware, then it's kind of a coin toss as to which one they've bothered packaging, links or e-links or links. So sometimes you end up using something else just because that's what's easy on that distribution. But if you're on Slackware anyway, I don't know, personally, I recommend L-Y-N-X, and I recommend it heartily and frequently. Like, again, not an everyday thing. You don't need it every day. But if you're building websites, or if you're just kind of curious as to what some other people's experience of the web might be, then going all the way back to something like L-Y-N-X, links, that gives you a picture of just how sort of, I guess, tolerant and sort of robust that website really is. And if that website's just telling you straight up, oh, you need JavaScript for this, or this browser isn't supported, or whatever, then I would argue that there's an accessibility problem there. Which, you know, I mean, maybe that website doesn't care about that. I mean, like, we all have to make choices at some point. Sometimes you just have to say, well, I'm not going to support a browser that can't do whatever. And that's the choice that they have made. Is that the right choice? Is it the best choice? I don't know. I guess it depends on your metric. If you're a business and you only care about your highest paying customers, then, you know, you can probably do a lot of things that excludes people without the same means as other people. And you don't care. That's an acceptable loss for you. But if you're a website trying to deliver information to a lot of people, then it probably is in your best interest and arguably the community's best interest for that website to be something that everyone can access, even on the most ridiculous, lowest bar web browser possible. And if you want to look at that, take a look at links. And if you want a cup of coffee, now is the time to get a cup of coffee. Come back, we'll finish up the show. Okay, I'm back. I have coffee. Same old story. Went to the city the other day, the big city of Dunedin. Went to a place where they sell coffee in big barrels and you scoop it out and put it into a container of your own. So turns out they're not big barrels, they're small barrels, and the size of my container is larger than most of the containers that hold coffee. So, long story short, I just went from left to right and just piled in scoops of coffee beans into this container until it was full. So I went through the Unite variety, the Unite blend, the Unwind blend, and the Traverse blend. I don't know who names these things, but that's what they're called. Unite, Unwind, Traverse, from left to right. So as I consume my coffee, not this cup, but like as I go through the coffee beans in my 1 kilogram container, I am going to see if I can tell when the different layers have, you know, when I'm transitioning from one variety, Traverse, down to Unwind, down to Unite. That's the challenge I've set out for myself. And frankly, based on the previous cups of coffee I've had, I kind of feel like I can tell that this is Traverse. It has a surprisingly, sort of bright or citrusy flavor to it. And by that, I don't mean either of those two things. And I've discussed previously how we don't seem to have words for flavors or sensations in the mouth. But this Traverse is actually billed. It's listed as like the, you know, darkest and boldest coffee, which I tend to shy away from, not because I don't like bold coffee, but because sometimes that's like code word for, we burned this coffee bean, sorry. We're going to call it bold now and try to sell it as if though it was intentional. So, and I don't care for that. That I do not care for, typically. I mean, sometimes I'll have something like that and be okay with it. But generally, yeah, I don't want it burned. But actually, it's not. It's really good. I don't know. Traverse might be my first option next time. Then I'll go Traverse, Unwind, Unite. Won't that be exciting? But for now, I have Unite, Unwind, Traverse from top to from bottom to top. And so right now I'm on Traverse, and it is a very good cup of coffee. I'm happy with it. Surprisingly so. Didn't expect to like it as much as this, and I do. And I think it's the bulk of the container. I think I got maybe the most of no, that wouldn't make sense. No, I got most of Unite, and then the dregs of Unwind, and then yeah, some probably, it's probably like half Unite, and then a quarter of Unwind, and then a quarter of Traverse. That's what I'm betting. And we'll see how that plays out, or if I can tell as well. That I'm not sure that I'll be able to tell, but that's the challenge. Okay, enough about coffee. Let's talk about MC Abber. I think the MC might stand for like Midnight Commander, maybe? I'm not sure. But McAbber is, or maybe it's a play on macabre? I don't know. McAbber is a Jabber client. Jabber is a chat, it is the nickname of a chat protocol called XMPP. Today, if you look up Jabber, it seems like it's some kind of technology owned by Cisco, which I don't think was ever true. So I don't know if Cisco just like decided that Jabber has sort of run its course and we're just going to reuse that name now, or do they have the trademark to Jabber or something? I don't know. But XMPP is the protocol anyway. So even back, you know, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, 10 years ago, when you're talking about Jabber, you're really talking about XMPP. XMPP made a lot of news at one point because, well, number one, it was a big alternative to like AOL Instant Messenger and things like that. But eventually it got adopted by Google for their nascent Google Chat client, or yeah, their chat service. Now that has changed probably several times, but notably it changed at some point to stop using Jabber, which broke a bunch of connections. And it was really annoying because I was on Jabber a lot and used it to speak to a lot of people because everyone had a Gmail account. And so it was just super easy to talk to people who were on Google. And that was the chat solution for such a long time. And it was great. And I'm talking about 2007, 2008, maybe 2009. It was just great. It was for you know, some number of years, you didn't have to think about what chat network am I going to be on? Because everyone was already on Gmail or GChat, and all you had to do was fire up your XMPP client, and then you could talk to people with their username at GChat or, you know, Google Chat or whatever it actually was. I don't remember. So that was really, really nice. But Google decided to walk away from that for whatever reason. I mean, it's not that their chat client has gotten any better. I mean, honestly, if anything, it's probably gotten worse. So I don't know what the decision process was there, obviously, not being Google. And so Jabber kind of, I feel like it kind of declined after that. And I don't know for sure. I mean, I'm not monitoring usage and I don't have any insight. I'm just saying my impression personally was that was when Jabber kind of started declining, simply because, yeah, people were suddenly not using Jabber, even though they didn't really know they were using Jabber in the first place. And now I guess apparently Cisco has like the name Jabber. Let's look really quick what this is. I've just typed in Cisco Jabber. Cisco Jabber is a software that enables instant messaging. Okay, so that's interesting. So they must be using XMPP for something for their chat, their internal chat or something, or their customer client chat. And I don't have any insight over a quick scan. They're not listing XMPP specifically, but wouldn't it be really weird to use the name Jabber and not have it be XMPP? That just doesn't make any sense. And yet XMPP.org doesn't list it. It doesn't really make, as far as I can tell, I see no mention of Jabber at all on XMPP, which kind of makes sense because, I mean, Jabber was using XMPP. XMPP is not Jabber. So I don't know the sort of the status of the Jabber term, but McAbber is a client for, it is an XMPP client and can talk to things over the Jabber, whatever, network. It can talk to other people over XMPP. The way to, and so McAbber is, I gotta get out of links here. McAbber is a terminal-based application. It is a little bit like IRSSI. So it's gonna take over your terminal and you'll have an interactive session with this network. And you can add friends or buddies or, you know, you can add names to your roster. And you can have chat sessions with them, and those chats will be there. If, you know, you'll log out, you'll log back in. Do you have any messages? Well, they'll be in red off to the left in the roster if there are things that they have said in your absence. So it's like, you know, a normal chat experience. You can also kind of do group chats, like a chat room, really. So it almost feels like IRC, except it has that third-party server involved that actually caches messages and so on. So it's kind of a nice experience. Like it'll feel like a really good sort of modern chat experience, but you're doing it in a terminal and it'll look like it's practically either IRC or, you know, something like that. To get started with McAbber, you do need to do anything useful, you need an account on a Jabber server or a XMPP network server, whatever. And one way to do that is to go to XMPP dot, where is it? XMPP dot, oh, providers dot XMPP dot net. That gives you a list of category A and category B and category C. And after that, you should probably stop reading. But I mean, the category A servers are those that are set up correctly. They pass all the tests. They let you register through your client and through a website. So there's a lot of flexibility. They're A-list. Category B has maybe some functionality, but maybe they don't let you register through both the app and the website. They just do one or the other. Or maybe they don't even. Maybe they're not $0, maybe you have to pay, maybe their registration is turned off entirely, but they do exist, and you might have friends there, but I mean, you know, maybe you won't be directly interacting with them. And then there's lower categories, but I mean, it would make sense to me to just focus on the A-list categories, and one that's listed there is nixnet.services, which is a a server run by a guy that I used to play D&D with. He's a great guy. He does amazing work. Nixnet.services, you should definitely check that out if you need a home away from home. Nixnet.services. It is a fantastic location. It's just got all kinds of cool services. So try it out if you need a good place to get like lots of cool open source services, like, you know, collaborative notepads and a Jabber server and a Mumble server and maybe even a Mastodon server. I could be wrong about that. But yeah, there's a bunch of stuff there. So nixnet.services, if you go to, I think it's just xmpp.nixnet.services, then you can register there. You can create yourself a username, enter nixnet.services as the server name, create a password, and you're in. Now you've got an XMPP, you've got an account on an XMPP server, so you can use that to in your credentials for Macabre. So Macabre, you need to get the example file, which lives in somewhere. Where is it? /var/log/packages/Macabre. Here it is. User doc or /usr/doc/mcabre-1.1.2/macabre-rc.example. That's the example configuration file. Now, according to Macabre, what it expects you to do is it wants you to copy that file, macabre-rc.example, as macabre-rc into a directory called /.macabre. So in other words, a hidden directory in your home. That was the old way of doing things. In the modern day Linux scene, really mostly people put their .config files into a folder, .config, which is just really nice. So I couldn't bring myself to make a .macabre folder out in my home directory. Just couldn't do it. So I made a Macabre, I copied that file, macabre-rc.example, to /.config/macabre-rc. Simple as that. Puts the config file in my .config folder, and there it is. Now, the trick, if you do that, though, is that you have to then launch macabre-f, as in file, and then the path to your configuration file. Because by default, it's going to look for /.macabre/macabre-rc. That won't exist. So you have to do a -f for file, -f /.config/macabre-rc. And then you're launching Macabre using your config file. But before you launch Macabre, I mean, you can launch it just to look at it, but before you launch it to use it, you do have to edit that configuration file. So if you open that configuration file in your text editor of choice, the only thing you need to add or change is the username at service name or domain name. And that is, of course, like the username that you just chose at nixnet.services or, you know, notclat2@nixnet.services, something like that, whatever you chose. And that's, I think, like line 2 or 3 in the config file. Everything after that, you can leave as is. I mean, you can change it later if you want, but I mean, to get started, that's all you need to do. And then just macabre-f /.config/macabre-rc, and then you're launched. You've got a client, a chat client running in your terminal, with sort of logged in. It'll log into Nixnet services, the XMPP server there, and then you have to find people to talk to. I mean, you may have people to talk to already. Like if you're signing up to XMPP because someone said, hey, I'm on XMPP, why don't you talk to me there? Then perfect. You've got their username, user and their server name. So you can add them to your buddy list and so on. If you don't know people, then, you know, you'll have to find people to talk to in your chat client. But I'm going to leave that as an exercise, as a social exercise for you, because I'm not particularly good at that side of things. And you wouldn't want to take advice from me on that one. Okay, so that's Macabre. The next one in the list, then, is Metamail. Metamail is an implementation of MIME, which I think we've talked about. It's the multi-purpose internet mail extension. which is the standard, or at least a proposed standard according to the text file, for multimedia mail over the internet. It's the thing that tells your computer, web browsers as well, what kind of file to expect, or how you want it to treat a specific file. So, for instance, if there's audio slash opus, then your computer believes that you are giving it an audio file of the opus codec, and it can then map what it opens that file in to your preferences. So if you've said, hey, I want all my opus files to open up in Firefox, then that's what happens. If you want all of your .webm files, though, to open up in, or MKV files, maybe, in VLC, then that's what will happen when it receives a, I don't know, a video slash Matroska, or whatever the MIME encoding, the MIME code for that is. So that's what MIME is. Metamail is an implementation of that system running on Slackware. Well, what does it mean to be running on Slackware? Well, it turns out that Metamail is it's the package. It is also a command, but just one command of many. So if you do a less on var log packages, there's, let's call it 15 little binaries. Not all of them are useful directly. Not all of them are useful at all to everyone. And some are quite cool. So there's Metamail itself, user bin Metamail. That's the application that gets called, if someone is using Metamail, to read the mailcap file to figure out, you know, what, how to display something that has come through an email message. Is this an image that I should render in the client, or is this a text file that I can just spit out into the client, or you know, what am I dealing with? That's Metamail can figure that out. Whether or not your mail client of choice actually uses Metamail is a completely different story. Like, some things have that kind of functionality built in, and you know, there's a lot of stuff that programmers can do on the client side to sort of deal with this standard, this MIME standard. But Metamail is one way to do that. And some of the binaries here, one of these 15 or 14 or, you know, 12 binaries or whatever it is, some of those are very specific to, well, what if we were using Metamail, and what if we did have an audio file that we wanted to play for the user? Well, we can call show audio, user bin show audio, and that would play the audio file, except it won't play the audio file unless you're on a Sony or a Sun workstation, apparently. That's what the man page says. Similarly, there's a program called Audio Compose, which will record a brief message that you can then email to someone. Apparently, maybe, was that a thing, or people thought it would be a thing? I'm not sure, but that's a thing that Metamail ships with, and so you could just call Audio Compose, and it would record a message that it could then email to your friend, except only on, again, a Sun or a Sony workstation with a microphone. It's a weird... that's what the man page says. It says, you know, known bugs or you know, limitations, whatever. It says that specifically, that it only works on Sony and Sun workstations. So that's just the audio stuff that seems to be limited, very limited to Sony and Sun. Probably almost certainly written before the days of like Pulse Audio and so on. So those are some of those applications. There's like show audio, I said that already, show external, show non-ASCII, show partial, show picture. You kind of get the idea. There is one that's kind of cool, MIME encode. And when I say it's cool, it's actually kind of redundant, but MIME encode will encode a file that you provide it into something that can be emailed. In layman's terms, or maybe not layman's terms, but in someone's terms, that's Base64. So if you want to email an image to someone in Base, you know, an image to someone, one way to get it to them without worrying so much about file formats and like what an attachment is and so on is just to make it a Base64 file. And that is essentially a functional file rendered as text that you can copy and paste And the person on the other end, if they know how to decode it from Base64, they'll end up with a valid file that they can open. It's an amazing technology. I don't know how it works. It's really, really cool. MIME encode, for whatever reason, kind of re-implements that. By default, it's a Base64 encoding. But if you do like MIME encode, and then I'll give it a path to this pixel.webp that I keep around because it's a really, literally a single pixel. Yeah, I get the Base64, a string of text that, you know, is Base64 encoding, and I could decode that with some Base64 decoder and get my WebP back out of it and display it in my GWEN view, just the one pixel. But you can do that with much larger things, obviously. Audio files, pictures. A lot of times that's how things are. Like, if you look at KMail, when you attach stuff, more often than not, I mean, there are different ways of doing all of these things, but I feel like the default method, at least on my KMail, because I have HTML and that sort of thing turned off, is just to attach it as Base64. So that's MetaMail, really. That's how that works. And, I mean, if that works. Like I say, not all applications, not all mail clients are going to use MetaMail. It's just one way of parsing mail. The next one is Mobile Broadband Provider Info. This is from the GNOME folks. It's a package containing mobile broadband settings for service providers in various countries. Not much to say about this. It is literally an XML document. I mean, and a DTD and you know, some of the infrastructure around XML, but it's basically an XML document that provides different broadband providers. APN value equals internet.orange, plan type, postpaid, usage type, internet, HEMA, USB, like just data like that. And it just goes on and on and on for a long time. Just all the different, or not all, but, you know, a bunch of the different providers out there. Obviously, this is text that gets rendered somewhere in some application, probably a network manager type application, maybe network manager, and presents to you a bunch of default or, like, you know, anticipated values, which, you know, many of those are probably still accurate. Some of them will have probably faded and so on, but that's a big database essentially of broadband providers. And that's nice when your computer kind of appears to know like what's going on in the world. That's kind of convenient usually. So yeah, I think that's probably a useful thing for some people. It's just, I have no experience with that sort of thing. Next up is MTR, which stands for, as far as I can tell, My Traceroute, and it is an all-in-one sort of traceroute ping hybrid, and it's kind of interesting. So it's in the SBIN folder, so you do need sudo permissions for it. So when you launch it, you'll do sudo MTR, and then let's just say google.com. That's an easy one. And it does exactly what you'd think it would do if I said it was a traceroute ping hybrid. It runs a traceroute from your current host to google.com, and it shows you each hop, but it also sends, it also actively pings each host, as far as I can tell, for as long as you have this display open, which I found kind of intriguing. Now, the pings are intentionally very, very low time to live, so if there's a failure, you're going to see it, and there are certain, I mean, some of these have failed, like there are hops here that are not responding to pings apparently. So yeah, it's an interesting overview of kind of like the moment that you did the trace route and then also kind of like the status of all of those places. It's interesting. It's an interesting little tool. There's a couple of different displays. You can order the fields differently. You can restart the statistics if you need to run everything over again. There's a little menu along the top that helps you with that. There's an Shift-H menu to get you to the keyboard shortcuts that you'll use in the interactive mode. But then there's also just the man page for it as well, which is quite informative. But that's it. I mean, as sort of you know, it takes over your terminal, so I kind of feel like it should, like there should be more to talk about. But I mean, honestly, I don't think there really is. It's a traceroute and a ping application all in one interactive interface, and that's what it is. It's kind of cool. You should take a look at it. I mean, if you're used to sort of the normal traceroute, take a look at the MTR version. It is kind of intriguing. And then last but certainly not least is the Mutt mail client. I feel like the Mutt mail client has sort of a reputation for being simple and yet very complex. So it's so simple that it's difficult to get started with. So I'm going to give you about maybe 18 lines, give or take, depending on your white space, a configuration file of a working Mutt configuration. It isn't that complex once you see it sort of written out, but it can get more complex, which I won't go into. But this is just a basic Mutt RC file that I use for my personal email. My work email is a lot more complex because it has to do a bunch of sorting on inbox folders and labels and non-standard email conventions used by terrible email companies. So that can get really, really complex. I mean, there's a lot of power there. There's a lot of configuration that you can do. The configuration options they're documented, but they can be a little bit difficult to find. I'll put some links into some useful resources in the show notes, but this is just a working Mutt RC file. And the place that this goes by default is in your home directory in a folder called .mutt, and in that .mutt file there must be a file called muttrc. Now you can put that somewhere else and launch mutt with a dash, I think it's a capital F as in file, and point it to a separate config file. You can certainly do that. I don't bother for this one. Not sure why. I guess I've just had a .mutt file or directory for such a long time that I never got around to moving it into .config. It's an acceptable outlier. Okay, so first line, set space editor equals Emacs. So you're probably getting kind of the sense already for this configuration file syntax. It's a little bit bash-like. The word set to set a variable or a property, and then the property name followed by an equal sign, and then the thing you want it set to. In this case, I just put Emacs because my entire system knows about Emacs. You could actually also just do a backtick, echo, I think you have to escape the dollar sign, backslash dollar sign editor, all capitals, close backtick, and that would escape the config file and run the bash command echo dollar sign editor. And if you have the editor, or you know, if you could use visual as well, if you have that, if you have that set to your favorite text editor, then Mutt will know that. And then if you set it to something else some other time, then Mutt also knows that, so you don't have to update that. So that's kind of a handy shortcut. But that's the first line. Doesn't have to be. That's where you're going to be composing your emails. All right, next line. Set my underscore name equals Klaatu. Set folder equals tilde slash mail, M-A-I-L. I use a capital M just to keep with the convention of capital folder, capital letter names in the home directory. This is a new directory that you'll have in your home directory. You need to create it with makedir, but that's where all of your emails will get stored. That's the top level directory, tilde slash mail. I know you're thinking, but isn't there like a var spool mail or something like that? And yes, you can do that, but then you have to fiddle around with like, it would be a different process. So you wouldn't, you probably don't actually want to do that. You're using your home directory as your data center, and you put all your data here. So put it into mail. Trust me, it's easier. Okay, next line, fourth line, set spool file, S-P-O-O-L-F-I-L-E, equals plus incoming. So what this does is it allows Mutt to create a file within your tilde slash mail. That's the shortcut, the plus sign. That's saying append incoming to the path tilde slash mail. Mutt, I think, gives you an error if that doesn't exist. So you could do a touch mail incoming, but I think it'll still be unhappy because that won't be an inbox file. So until Mutt actually gets some mail from a server, you might see like some warnings about that, but that's not you don't have to worry about that, as I recall. Fifth line, set pop underscore authenticators equals whatever authentication method you want to use for logging into a server. I'm assuming, I use POP3 for my home email. I don't mess with IMAP, so you can mess with IMAP. Most mutts at this point have been compiled with IMAP support, so you can just do IMAP natively. It's basically the same process. Set IMAP underscore authenticators and so on. But I'm not going to do that here. I'm just going to use POP. But you'll see in the in various examples online, which I'll link to in the show notes, you'll see how IMAP is done really, really similarly. It's not that big of a deal. Historically, IMAP was not supported directly in MUT, as I recall, and some people had to patch it, and other people had workarounds and all these other things. But these days, it's built in. So the different POP authenticators would be user, APOP, digest MD5, GSS API, or cram-MD5. You can list them all, delimited by colons, and use the property set space POP underscore auth underscore try underscore all to tell it to try all of the authentication methods. I happen to know what my server uses, so I just put user because that's what I need. Set space POP underscore check interval equals, I don't know, whatever you want in seconds, let's say 660 seconds, so 660. Set POP underscore delete equals ask dash no. In my case, I do not delete it from the server. I have my Kmail email application is kind of my main emailer, so I just have that sort of be the one that actually removes stuff from the server. But you could certainly do it, you know, you can manage that your own, however you want to manage it. Set space POP underscore host equals, and then this one can get confusing because you need to know, strangely, your login name to the email server. And you might think, well, that's super obvious. I mean, in my case, it would be Klaatu. But is it, though? Because sometimes an email server or an email provider sets the username to, like, the full email address, like klaatu@example.com, which would render your POP host as POP S, probably, if you're using SSL. So POP S :// klaatu@example.com @example.com:995 or whatever port you're using. Again, if you're using like SSL stuff, you're probably 995 to check your mail. So you do need to know your actual user, your actual like authentication username. And you might think of that as just the part before the at symbol, and that may or may not be correct. You can try one, and if it fails, then try the other if you're not sure. It just depends on the way that your email server is set up. Okay, next line, the ninth line, set space POP underscore reconnect equals ask dash yes. This isn't actually required, but I figure it's a good property to have. It essentially reconnects to your POP host if it's disconnected. So I don't know, it seems like a useful option to have. I guess that shouldn't be in here, but it is. So there you go. 10th line, set record equals plus sent. So this is the place where all of your emails are recorded. That's going to go in the plus. That refers back to that set folder path, which was /mail. So this is going to add an inbox file or something. I think it's inbox plus, sent, S-E-N-T, into your mail directory. Okay, next line, 11th line, set real name equals Klaatu, or whatever your real name is. Set space from equals klaatu@example.com. That is the, so both of those items that we're in the SMTP section now, I should have mentioned. Both of those items, the real name and the from, that's your name and from field in your sent email. The next line, which is what, the 13th line, that's your SMTP URL. So set space SMTP underscore URL equals, and then you give your SMTP address. So that might be, I don't know, SMTP :// klaatu@example.com at example.com/587 or whatever you use for your SMTP. It'll depend on, you know, whether you're using Stark TLS or SSL or whatever. So or whatever your email host is using, and then set space SSL_start TLS equals yes if that's relevant for you. If not, then you might do a set, set force SSL equals yes, and so on. So there are different ways to ensure that SSL is being used. I know what it is. Set SSL_force_TLS, whatever's relevant for you. And there are lots of other SSL options, and there are password management options, which I'm not going to go into because this is just a bare minimum. So that's 14 lines of configuration. And if you save that and then go to your terminal and launch Mutt, you are greeted with a pretty empty screen without much of an indication of how you use the application. Now, along the top, you can see sort of a menu, Q for quit, D for delete, U for undelete, S for save, M for mail, R for reply, G for group, and question mark for help. So if you hit the question mark for help, you get a bunch of information that you probably don't need right away. But if you hit the space bar, then it goes down a screen. Of course, I'm assuming your screen is exactly the same size as mine. But after a bunch of sort of advanced things, there are single keystrokes that I think are more often than not the thing that you're going to use initially. I mean, certainly the letter G for get mail or fetch mail as they list it. Why provide a mnemonic when it's so obvious? So if you hit, I always hit shift G. I don't actually know if it has to be. Yeah, it does. Okay. Oh yeah, because lowercase g would be group. That's why I always hit shift G. So I hit shift G and that starts to log in to my POP server. Now it stops in this configuration because I haven't given it a password. I've given it my username and my domain name, but I haven't given the password to complete the authentication. So you can do that. You can type your password here. Mutt will pass that over to your authenticator, and eventually you'll get logged in as long as you've got all your settings correct. That does get rather tedious. You can use GNU PG, or really PGP are the options, but I mean that just invokes GNU PG to store your password. You could also use the pass command, which is what I use lately. I used to use GPG for it, but then I realized you could just invoke pass and get your password that way, which I mean really does use GNU PG, but it's sort of a different way of invoking it. So you can do that. And then you don't have to type in your password, but you're also not just typing your password in your config file and leaving it out in plain text on your system. So that's quite nice. But again, I'm not gonna get into that. I'll link to some resources where you can read more about that. So if you have new email on your server, then you see a very sort of recognizable, you know, kind of list of names and email addresses and subject lines, and you can read those just as you might expect, just really just arrow keys and return keys. And if you want to reply to one, you just hit the R key for reply. Or if you don't have anything and you want to compose a message, you can hit M for mail. And that gives you a prompt at the bottom of the window for who you want to send that to. And then it gives you the option to put in a subject line. And once you've got those two fields filled out, it launches your text editor. So in my case, that's Emacs. And then you can type some text, hello world. I don't know if that'll get through or if it'll get spam, flagged as spam, who knows. But I'll save that and exit Emacs. And now I can just, according to the top row here, the little menu bar at the top in Mutt, if I hit Y, it'll send the message. Okay, so it's acting like it's going to send, but again, it's interrupting itself to prompt me for a password because I didn't give it an SMTP password, because I in real life, I would be using pass or GPG or whatever system I wanted to use to sort of intercept that, step in and take care of that for me. But in this very basic 14-line configuration, I haven't done that. So if I type in my password, then it sends the email. And I can confirm that it has been sent by going, because I've sent it to myself at a different email address. So I'll go over to my Kmail and hit get mail a couple of times. And there it is. Test email from Mutt. Hello world from klaatu@example.com, let's say. So yeah, there's Mutt. That's all it takes, really. Like I say, it's got a reputation for being simple, and that's because when you launch it, it's basically a blank screen, so there it doesn't get much simpler than that. The options are quite complex. Whether or not fiddling around with a config file for several days or several weeks or several months or for the rest of your life is something that you're interested in is kind of up to you. I mean, there is a lot out there for Mutt. You have to kind of dig around for it. But there's just a sort of an astonishing amount. I mean, to the point that, you know, there are little scripts to, well, certainly, I mean, options to do all the GNU-PG stuff. You can encrypt your messages and decrypt messages. There are scripts that you can put into your config file to make it really easy to, for instance, expose links in a message and then launch a web browser to go to that link. Because, I mean, Mutt doesn't do that on its own. You could select the text in the message, copy it, and paste it into your Firefox browser or whatever. But, I mean, there's no hyperlinking in Mutt. It's just the plain text. There are filters that you can pipe HTML messages through to give you plain text. There are applications or little scripts that'll add like side panels to Mutt. I mean, you can just do whatever you want. Seemingly, it's just a matter of either inventing the method of doing it or finding the 1,000-line config file that has all of these hidden gems in it. And that is my work email, my work Mutt file rather, is an amalgamation of options taken from like Paul Frields from the Fedora project and Kyle Rankin from formerly of Linux Journal. All of those options dumped into my config file with my own customizations, humble customizations. I mean, really just the stuff that's necessary. All the fun stuff, all the cool stuff is really just other people's configurations pasted into mine and adjusted to work with whatever server I'm actually targeting. I think another aspect of sort of simple being complex is that an empty config file or a config file with 1,000 lines of every possibility can be very overwhelming. So really try to, I think if you're going to start using Mutt, you do want your first configuration file to be roughly 14 lines. I wouldn't have known that before doing this for this episode, but I mean, that's kind of the bare minimum. You need about 14 lines so that you can just know what, oh, that's funny. I don't have my .mutrc in my .mut folder. Isn't that weird? Anyway, yeah, so it's about 14 lines, you know, just to set your folder path, basically, to set your login credentials, whether it's for POP or for IMAP, and then to set your SMTP server. And for some providers, it's this simple. It's just talking to servers. For other providers, it's a whole, it's just jumping through a bunch of hoops for you know, like either getting around two-factor authentication by getting like a developer key or whatever they're called, a rescue code, or going through, you know, some process that they have developed because they want you to go to their site. So you're kind of hacking around their systems. It can get complex, even though, again, Mutt itself is quote-unquote simple. So I guess simple is a bad word for it. It's really minimal. Mutt is very minimal. It doesn't give you much by default, but there is a lot to work with. But whether you know what you have to work with, what your options are, how to configure them, how to make them useful, what your server expects from you, which server you're even talking to, whether you've got one server for incoming and a different one for outgoing, what your username actually is, and so on. All of that stuff, I mean, that's figuring it out. That's the beauty of email, really, which, you know, is kind of a pity that it's even now that complex. But that's the nature of these configurations. So Mutt is it's powerful, it's it's cool. It can be overwhelming. Hopefully this has kind of shed some light on how to get started with it. And try it out if you're curious. I would, if you're juggling, if you want to do email in a terminal and you're thinking Mutt or Alpine, I mean, I'm biased and I would say Mutt because to me, once you kind of get the hang of it, it's got a really great sort of workflow. But I do have to kind of admit that Alpine, probably for that upfront configuration, may be a little bit less intimidating. I don't know whether it's easier, but it's less intimidating. I mean, honestly, I don't know whether configuring stuff to get and send email is ever easy. It just isn't, really. Like, I think Thunderbird is probably the best experience for that. And even then, I mean, it really depends on who your email provider is anyways. You know, is it something well known where most of the configuration can be done for you? Or is it something that you're just renting from some provider or something that you're running yourself? So lots of variables to think about, but Mutt is a very sort of very flexible program where you can kind of, because there's so little to it, you can end up, you know, you're working in Emacs or whatever your favorite text editor rather than Mutt itself. And that's kind of nice. It kind of separates the sort of the email, the act of emailing from the literal act of sending an email. Mutt just kind of manages an inbox, really. That's all it's responsible for. Everything else is just talking to servers or talking to external applications. And that is, I think, everything. So what, I had 520 episodes at one point, so, or packages rather, so 510, so what, 500 more packages to go? That's exciting. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. My name's Klaatu. You can reach me anytime over email with feedback or comments, tips, or just to say hi. My email address is klaatu@slackermedia.info. You can also reach me on the Mastodon network, not Klaatu, at mastodon.xyz. The show's intro and outro music is by Fat Chance Lester. You can find their music on bandcamp.com or on gnuworldorder.info. In the archive, you'll find a music directory containing the album from which this music has been extracted. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep the source open.
I'm sure it's only a joke in very poor taste.